Welcome to episode 619 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another Marvel Monday episode, and I'm going to be talking today about a few recent Marvel books, namely Dead Man Logan number 1, Fantastic Four number 4, Ironheart number 1, and then I'm going to be continuing my look at the Charles Soule run of Daredevil with issue 11. So a few books to get to. Let's dive right into it. We'll start with Dead Man Logan, number 1 of 12 limited series, and it's written by writer Ed Brisson. We have art by Mike Henderson, color art by Nolan Woodard, and letters by VC's Corey Petit, cover by Declan Shalvey. And for those not familiar with Dead Man Logan, so it's actually this final story, supposedly, of Old Man Logan, which is a version of Wolverine that was transported to the present from an alternate or possible future timeline where the villains of the Marvel Universe ultimately triumphed and the world kind of devolved into a lawless wasteland. And Logan, Old Man Logan, came back here, saw that it was far in the past, and he had a chance to maybe prevent a lot of the things that caused the ultimate downfall of his world. And so he was able to rejoin the X-Men and kind of take the spot of our Logan, the Wolverine from this world, who died in Charles Soule's Death of Wolverine miniseries. So there are a few things to be aware of, though. I've never read an Old Man Logan story, so all I have is what I know from this issue, and there's a few things that are really obvious from this issue. One, he only has adamantium claws in one hand. The other hand is the bone claws. So that's kind of interesting. And also, because of his advanced age, his healing factor has been severely reduced. And so he's slowly dying of adamantium poisoning. The adamantium that has allowed him to be the best he is at what he does for so long is now literally killing him. So the issue starts off with some of the younger X-Men finding Logan in the snow, and Cecilia says there's a faint pulse, barely, but we need to get him out of here. He needs immediate medical attention. And Forge says, "Well, it looks like a hell of a fight went down here." Glob's like, "That's not the Hulk, is it? It looks like the Hulk." And we see the body and the head have been separated. And Ford says, "Yeah, it sure looks like it, but whatever it was, it's dead now. Damn, hell of a fight for sure." And they get Logan on a stretcher and get him onto the plane. He wakes up in the X-Mansion a while later and kind of freaking out. "Get this off me. What's going on? Where am I?" And they're saying, "Logan, calm down. It's okay. Safe place. You're in the mansion. You're with friends." And Logan wants to know how long he's been out. Well, it's been 11 days. And so Cecilia says, "When we found you, you were barely alive. Weren't sure you were going to survive the trip back, but the Regenix readings have spiked. Your healing factor is trying to stop it from eating away at your organs while also trying to combat your adamantium poisoning. And did you take another dose of Regenix even after I warned you what it would do to your system?" And Wolverine says, "Well, my healing factor shot. I needed it to take down Maestro." So that's who that Hulk, I mean, it was Hulk, right? Hulk from the future. Future Imperfect storyline by Peter David. So Cecilia goes on to tell him, "You've overloaded your system. Your healing factor can't keep up. In my estimation, if we can manage the symptoms." And Logan's like, I know all this. Just tell me. Just tell me how long I got." And Cecilia says, "Well, you've got 12 months to live." So he gets dressed, he leaves, and a Glob is following him. Logan says, "There was a backpack." "Yeah, we got it. It's with your stuff. Hey, can you show me where it is?" And Glob's like, "You know, if Cecilia can't help you, maybe the Beast or Mr. Fantastic or Doctor Strange." And Old Man Logan says, "I'm past that, right? I've been lucky, lived longer than most. It hasn't all been good, but the good times have outweighed the bad, and I'm ready to move on. I'm ready to be with my wife and kids," because this version of Logan was married, did have a wife and kids, didn't pop his claws for like 50 years. So he's ready. He's ready to go if that's the case. But he says, "I just need to settle a couple things first and make sure I leave this world a little better than I found it." And Glob says, I want to go with you. And Logan says, I've got some things I've got to wrap up, but you haven't seen the last of me, kid. So he heads to the bar with No Name, where he asks after Mysterio. And we see the villains there saying they're not snitches. They're not going to tell him what he wants to know. And he's like, all right, don't say I didn't warn you. And he proceeds to beat the crap out of just about everybody there. Slide, the Tarantula, it looks like Backlash or Whiplash at one point. Everybody but Miss Sinister. Crossfire looks like he's there as well. And nobody will give him any answers about where Mysterio might be. And so he doesn't attack Miss Sinister, as she says that testosterone in this place is so thick you could cut it with a chainsaw. And Logan says, hey, I'm surprised to find you here with these lowlifes and Z-level nobodies. And Miss Sinister says, well, you know, you're looking for bad boys. You go where the bad boys go. Too bad they weren't quite bad enough for my taste. And she says, I'm going to chalk this up as a learning experience. And Logan says, you know, if I thought for a second you knew where Mysterio was, you'd be just a pile of meat on the ground with the rest of the meat. And she says, well, I guess I should be thankful. Happy hunting. And she grabs a knife from behind the bar as Logan leaves, walks up to Tarantula and says, you know, I'm pretty impressed. You didn't tell Logan any of the little secrets you have locked up in that mind of yours, even as he was kicking your butt. And Tarantula's like, why can't I move? And Miss Sinister says, well, because I don't want you to move. But it's okay. I'm a telepath. Reading minds gives me an unfair advantage. So you can die knowing that you never really snitched, but you never could have hidden your secrets from me. So obviously with Logan asking the questions, the answers to those questions were at the forefront of Tarantula's mind. He was like thinking of them. And even though he didn't tell Logan, it allowed Miss Sinister to find out the answers. And so we see back at the X-Mansion, Glob is asking after Wolverine, trying to find out where he went. And Glob says, he left. Well, where did he go? Don't know. Says, okay. It's a very strange scene. Like, I don't... Why? Why does Logan... Like, if Forge wants to know where Logan is, why doesn't he just call him? But Glob says, he left a few hours ago, said he needed to take care of something. Forge says, don't suppose he said what he needed to take care of? Nope. All right, well, if you need him, or if you see him, tell him I need to talk to him. I don't know. It's just weird. It's a weird scene. So anyway, Brooklyn, New York is where we are in the next scene. And we see we're at a warehouse where one of the villains at the Bar With No Name suggested that Mysterio might have been. And the only thing left of Mysterio is one of his little illusion spheres. Old Man Logan picks it up, dusts it off. And a voice behind him says, Mysterio hasn't been here for more than a year. And it's Hawkeye and says, hey, pretty good, sneaking up on Logan, right? To which Logan responds, yeah, I noticed you about a mile back. You smell like Axe body spray, coffee, and desperation. It's hard to miss. Hawkeye's like, ouch. Anyway, I heard you beat up a whole bar of bad dudes. You're asking about Mysterio, and I figured he was Spider-Man's problem or Daredevil. Seems a little outside your usual purview, but I thought I'd look into it, you know? And I thought maybe I could help. And Old Man Logan just kind of stares him down. He says, look, I know where Mysterio is, but I gotta know what you want before I tell you. Logan says, nope, it's my problem, Hawkeye. I'm doing it my own way. He says, listen, haven't we done this before? Wolverine, can't we just skip past the part where you tell me to get lost and the part where you get so annoyed at me pestering you to help? You eventually relent and you say, you'll let me help you if I just stop talking all the time. So I love it. Like they skip over like two pages of Wolverine saying no, Hawkeye being persistent, annoying him to the point where Wolverine's finally like, fine, you can help. I'll say anything just to shut you up. So Wolverine says, look, Mysterio, where I came from, nearly every single superhero, every X-Men, every Avenger was killed and their blood was on my hands. Hawkeye's like, what did you do? Mysterio made me think I was protecting them, made it seem like the mansion was being invaded by every villain the X-Men ever faced. He made it seem so real, and normally I can see through illusions. I can smell my way past them, but not this time. I was fooled, and the X-Men lost their lives. I killed every one of them because of Mysterio, and after that, that's when the world started falling apart. And the night it would have happened has already passed by on this world, But if Mysterio did it in my timeline, he can do it in this timeline as well. So I'm going to make sure that that can happen. And so it's interesting, like, you almost wonder, was Hawkeye going to say, well, I'm not going to, are you going to kill him? I'm not going to tell you where he is then. But instead he says, I'm sorry, I didn't know. But he's still going to tag along. And if push comes to shove, I wouldn't expect Hawkeye to allow Wolverine to kill Mysterio, but I guess we'll see. So Wolverine's like, all right, I told you, so where is he? And Hawkeye says, well, I called Spider-Man. He told me sometimes it's easier to ask for help. Wolverine's like, just tell me where. And on the next page, we see that Mysterio is actually in a mansion being waited on hand and foot, sitting next to a roaring fire. And all of a sudden, we see it's an illusion. It melts away. Miss Sinister is there saying, wow, how pathetic is this? There's not a hot shower in the, there's not a shower hot enough in the world to make me feel clean again. Mysterio's like, who are you supposed to be? What are you doing in here? I'm like, hey, I came to get you out of this place, but now I'm starting to have second thoughts because there's a lot to unpack here. Mysterio's immediately, nope, nope, not leaving. This is where I belong. Done with that life. And Miss Sinister says, yes, this looks so much better. But Mysterio's point is, look, I'm done getting my ass kicked. Spider-Man Daredevil taking turns beating me. Deadpool humiliated me, drove over me with a dune buggy. I just want to be left alone. I can't take it anymore. I'm safe in here. I have my routine. There's no Spider-Man. There's no Daredevils. There's no Deadpools. Just go away. Let me rot in peace. And Miss Sinister says, I don't think you understand. I poked around in Logan's brain and I saw some very interesting things. Things that involve you. Things that you didn't even know you're capable of. So what if I told you we can finally win this thing? We can finally have a world without X-Men, without Avengers, without Deadpool, without Spider-Man, and you're the one who can do it. Mysterio says, nope, not interested, staying here. He's heard it all before. So Miss Sinister tries a different tack and says, well, what if I told you in 5 minutes Logan's going to be here and he's going to slice you open from stem to sternum? Yeah, that'll probably do it. So meanwhile, at that very same hospital, we see Hawkeye and Wolverine arrive, walk right in the front door with Logan saying, this is stupid. We should be going through the roof, not the front door. Hawkeye's like, man, sometimes it pays to do things by the book. Tells the nurse, we're here to see Quentin Beck. Can you tell us what room he's in? And the nurse says, are you his family or lawyers? Hawkeye says, nope, I'm an Avenger. Sorry, family and legal counsel only. Hawkeye again, but I'm an Avenger. And the nurse says, well, I'm aware of the Avengers. Captain America, Thor, Hulk, Iron Man, you aren't any of them. Hawkeye says, well, there's more than just four Avengers. She says, of course there is. Black Widow, Black Panther, Ant-Man, Stingray. Stingray? Stingray? Hawkeye says, how do you know Stingray and not me? Really? Like, sorry. Don't know ya. He says, I'm Hawkeye. Hot guy? Now I know you're not. Now I know you're putting me out. I'm not letting you in. He says, no, Hawk Eye, like the bird and the eyeball. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. You look much more like a bird than a hot guy. But still doesn't matter. You're not family. You're not a lawyer. You're not getting in. So meanwhile, Logan's phone rings. It's Glob calling saying Forge is looking for you. And Logan, just like my point, well, why isn't he calling me then? I don't know. He wanted me to tell you. Did he say why? Glob says, no, just said he was looking for you. All right, well, you deliver your message, and if you see him again, you tell him if it's important, he can call me himself. Right now, I got some other stuff that needs to be taken care of. We see Hawkeye still trying to get through the door. The nurse is telling him no exceptions, lawyers, family only. Now get out of here before I call security. So Wolverine says, come on, hot guy. She's not letting us in. Let's go. Now we try it my way. So meanwhile, at the Midtown South Police Department, we see that Miss Sinister and Mysterio have broken in and gotten all his equipment back. Mysterio's like, you know, we could have gotten in and out with my illusions and they never would have known we'd been here. And Miss Sinister's like, yeah, we could have, but we don't have time for that. It's a whole new era and there's going to be a lot more blood spilled. So we're going to meet some people that do not want to be kept waiting. Meanwhile, Hawkeye and Wolverine sneak in to the hospital. They talk to some of the other patients there. They find out that Miss Sinister came and took him away, and where he went, not sure. Meanwhile, Forge is in his laboratory in an undisclosed location. He sets the I guess, some kind of trans-dimensional doorway for the last known location. And he says, okay, let's see where we go. And he walks through, and when he comes out of the cave, he is in the wasteland. So I think maybe he has some idea of what Old Man Logan might be up to, and wants to have an understanding of what exactly is going on. So meanwhile, at an undisclosed location in the Pacific Ocean, Miss Sinister and Mysterio have arrived, and it turns out that the organization Miss Sinister is working with that wants to take advantage of what Mysterio is capable of, what Miss Sinister saw in Logan's mind, is a new Hydra, Neo Hydra. And we see Crossbones there, as well as other members of Hydra, all shouting, yes, or all shouting, hail Neo Hydra, to which Miss Sinister responds, yes, hail Neo Hydra, indeed. So, interesting start. As I said, I didn't know much about Old Man Logan before this started. He seems like Logan to me, but, you know, obviously older, not quite as strong or as powerful as the Logan from our reality. I do find it interesting that, again, Hawkeye was willing to go along after Old Man Logan told him why he wanted to find Mysterio. Again, it seems like he would be like, I know, I'm not going to put you in a room with that guy. It sounds like you're going to kill him. And is it a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way? Because it seems like Mysterio was content to just hang out in the mental hospital until Old Man Logan went looking for him. And by looking for him, he then caught the attention of Miss Sinister, who now wants to use that knowledge that she gleaned from Tarantula to perhaps cause that future to happen. So I like the idea of Logan trying to tie up loose ends. That does seem very authentic. It does seem like a very Wolverine thing to do. And yeah, you know, at one point he's like, I just want to see my wife and kids. I want to be with my wife and kids again. Because there is that aspect that, you know, Logan will never stop fighting. So you kind of wonder, well, does that make sense? That he would be willing to accept it? That he's not going to go to Doctor Strange or Mr. Fantastic or Beast or, you know, somebody else to try to boost his healing factor again? I think it does. I think it is in character with Logan's, or it is in keeping, I should say, with Logan's character. So the art by Mike Henderson is solid. It's not my favorite comic art. It's a little sketchy. It's a little loose, but it suits the story very well. I think he especially draws Mysterio and Miss Sinister very, very well. The color work by Matt Milla is solid, as, you know, come to expect from Matt. He's a very talented colorist. So the color work by Nolan Woodard is very solid. I'm not familiar with Nolan's work. The name sounds vaguely familiar. I may have seen his work on a previous Marvel issue or two, but it's done very well. It's sort of neutral colors, I'll say. It's kind of, the colors are kind of hanging in the background, so to speak. And what I mean by that is a lot of times color helps set the tone and the mood. You know, I've likened color before in podcasts to like the background music or the soundtrack in movies, where it can, like in a horror movie, for example, the tension starts being ratcheted up by the music, you know, coming to a crescendo or whatever. I kind of feel like this color work is so neutral that it's not providing any mood or tone. It's very much in the background, and it's allowing kind of the dialogue and the pacing of the story from Ed Brisson to kind of set the mood and the tone on its own. I don't necessarily think that will continue, because I think as we learn more about what's going on, I expect the colors to start to flesh out the story a little more. This issue is a lot of setup. And so I feel like, I don't know if Nolan did it on purpose or if that's just his style, but I definitely feel like there's more to be done with tone and story and pacing in terms of the color. So, but I did very much enjoy this first issue. As I said, I haven't read any previous Old Man Logan stories. So I like this one, and I plan on picking up the rest of the issues. Ed Brisson is really starting to become a writer that I know I need to pay attention to, because his work is really, really well done. So I'm definitely on board for the final adventure here for Old Man Logan. All right, let's see. Up next from Marvel, I have Fantastic Four number 4. This is from the creative team of writer Dan Slott. We have Stefano Caselli and Nico Leone on art. We have Eric Arseniglia on color art with Chris Iliopoulos handling the letters. And it starts off where Earth, New York City, right across from the Baxter Building. A reporter is mentioning that this has always been a really safe neighborhood because who would ever rob a store right across the street from the Baxter Building? Well, the Fantastic Four hasn't been around for a long time. And so the answer of who would rob a building or a jewelry store right across from the Baxter Building is the Wrecking Crew. So we see Bulldozer, the Wrecker, Pile Driver, and Thunderball. And as they're leaving the jewelry store with their loot in hand, he says, out of my way, pretty boy. The smartest play ever was robbing this jewelry store right now because we all saw the giant four go up in the sky. We all know the Fantastic Four and everybody who's ever been in the Fantastic Four all disappeared. So it's the perfect time to strike. It's open season out there and there's nobody who can stop us. So that, you know, that's a reference to what we saw last issue when Reed set off the four, and not only did Ben and Johnny teleport over to the other dimension where the Fantastic or the Future Foundation was, but anyone who had ever been a member of the Fantastic Four ever. So Wolverine, Ghost Rider, Spider-Man, Hulk, Crystal, Luke Cage, Iceman at some point apparently was a member of the Fantastic Four, Sharon Carter, or Sharon Ventura rather, the female thing. Black Panther, Storm, and others that I'm forgetting as well. Did I say Crystal? Anyway, we see a girl in the crowd after Wrecker makes his announcement says, yeah, loser, that's where you're wrong. There's a new group of heroes in town that are ready to answer the call, and she fires off a flare gun. And before we know it, there's four new heroes that show up. They says, hey, everybody, no need to worry. We're here. We're the Fantastics. If you're posting online, that's Fantastics with an X. The baddest, the best, except no substitutes. And then one of them says, but actually, Jack, that's exactly what we're asking them to do. And he responds, don't, Daryl, don't ruin this, man. Sorry. But that is what they're asking him to do, right? To accept some substitutes. So meanwhile, many multiverses away, we see that Mr. Fantastic is finishing up the final redesign on a teleportation pod. He's having Johnny solder in the last piece. Johnny responding, yep, that's what I'm here for. Johnny Storm, the human blowtorch. And Luke Cage expresses some misgiving, saying, redesign, this thing is going to get me home to my wife and kid, right? And Valeria says, yeah, the tachyon redistributor is unchanged and intact. And every one of your particles will be returned to their last location on Earth. And they decide to do it in waves, just to not tax the power supply. So Mr. Fantastic flips the switch and teleports Storm, Iceman, Luke Cage, Namorita, and Luke back to Earth. And as he's starting to dematerialize, Iceman says, just to double check, you only brought official members of the FF, right? Which means I'm one. My adventure way back when totally counted. Cool. And Johnny Storm, nah. To which Iceman responds, sorry, Flame Brain can't hear you. Bye. As he's fading out. And Johnny, again, that didn't count. And we get a little note from Tom Brevoort saying, it will. You'll see the story next year. So meanwhile, Reed and Sue go and meet up with the other members of the Future Foundation. And they try to decide what they're going to do. Reed says, Dragon Man, are you and the others sure about this? You know, there's more than enough power to get us all home. Dragon Man says, no. Owen Reese was our friend. If there's even a chance that even one molecule of him survived, we may find a way to bring him back. And Thing says, you're going to look for one molecule in a whole universe? And they say, well, do you doubt us? That's what the Future Foundation is. And Ben says, that's the spirit, kid. So Meanwhile, Black Panther is asking Anome if he's going to, if she rather is going to come back home with them. But she says, I'm sorry, my king, these friends have become like family. My place is by their side. And Black Panther says, oh, I totally understand. I'm proud of you. And Sue Storm tells Alex Power that Reed and her, they really believe that all the work that he's done there, he's earned himself a professorship. And they're going to put in the paperwork once they get back to Earth. And Alex says, wait, I'm more qualified than Dragon Man? And she says, yep, actually you are. So it's time for you to step up. You ready? And he says, Professor Power and the Future Foundation. Not bad. I like the sound of that. So the rest of the foundation all says bye to Valeria and Franklin, says they're going to miss them for sure. And Valeria says, don't worry, I'll figure out a way to text you across the dimensions, I promise. So Reed tells Dragon Man, stay in touch. And if you need something or you're done here and you're ready to come home, just let me know. And also let us know if, and Dragon Man says, if the Griever returns. And Reed says, yes, we barely survived. And Dragon Man says, don't worry, I swear to you, I'll keep the children safe from her or any threat. You have my word on that. So the Future Foundation is in good hands, and they leave to keep exploring and learning. So meanwhile, it's time for another wave of heroes to leave. So when they go to teleport the last of the extended family, as Johnny calls it, it's the new Fantastic Four. And Spider-Man comments, well, maybe we should call it the Fantastic Three because the Hulk was a no-show. And Wolverine says, yeah, we could have used him in that scrape. Guess he's a hard guy to track down now. And Spider-Man says, well, speaking of which, are you really back, Wolverine? Like, is this an old you, an alternate past version of you? Like, what? And he says, we ain't talking about it. So, again, not sure where it fits in with what's going on in Return of Wolverine and, you know, the rest of those books. He doesn't have his memory back there. So, is he from a different timeline? Is he from the past when before he died? Who knows? So, Spider-Man's like, all right, fine. What about you, Ghost Rider? Are you the one I know? Are you the guy running around with Avengers now? Or are you the guy with the car? Or are you the original? He says nothing, and Spider-Man says, ah, got it, not talking about it. So Reed Richards, enough of that. I'm going to set the coordinates. I'll get you back, and the rest of you can go home. And then we can get home back to the Baxter building. And Spider-Man's, ugh. Nobody told you. I'm so sorry. Seriously, it's all on me. As he fades out. And Reed Richards says, that was odd. And Johnny's like, yeah, about that. Because he needs to tell him about the Baxter building, right? Like the fact that Peter bought it when he had Parker Industries and he was like a billionaire. And then he had to sell it because of his debts. And anyway, before Johnny can tell Reed, Reed says, well, it's almost as odd as the teleporter not bringing the Hulk here as well. And Johnny says, yeah, about that, because we did see that the Hulk was there, only let himself be seen by Johnny. And this has everything to do with what's going on in the Immortal Hulk series. So Johnny Storm calls out, Dr. Banner, coast is clear, safe to come out now. And Johnny tells the rest of Fantastic Four, yeah, he didn't want the others to know he was here. And Reed's like, yeah, so it did work. And Banner's not happy about that. He's like, yeah, it did. And I don't like being manipulated that way. Send me back now. And Reed says, of course. And Banner goes, and I'd be careful. My other half, things aren't the way they used to be. And he has a way of holding grudges. And Thing says, oh, yeah, that ain't going to come back to bite us in the butt. Clearly thinking that it will. So the Fantastic Four then teleports themselves back to Earth as Reed says, next stop, the Baxter building. And Thing says, oi, are you going to tell him, kid, or am I? And so as they rematerialize in front of the Baxter building, Johnny Storm tells them, yeah, we lost the Baxter building, not ours anymore. It wasn't me. Spidey became a billionaire, bought it, lost everything, sold it. And Invisible Woman says, Spidey was a billionaire? Johnny's like, yeah, trust me, there was a lot of strange stuff going on. Deadpool and I became Avengers. Yeah, really strange time. And Franklin says, wait, they made you an Avenger? You? And Johnny's like, hey, it's not that big of a surprise. Meanwhile, we see a crowd across the street holding up signs that say, go Fantastics, go. And Sue's like, well, that was fast. Look at, we already got a crowd cheering us. And Franklin said, I don't think that's for us, Mom. And Valeria chimes in and says, yeah, something tells me it's for them. And we see the Fantastics attacking the Wrecking Crew. And Johnny's like, what the? We've only been gone a couple hours. We've already been replaced. And Reed says, well, technically, Sue, the kids and I were away longer. Johnny's like, that's not important. Big picture here. They should be, that should be us over there. And they've got matching uniforms. Man, we're so off our game. So Johnny immediately runs in, wants to get back into action. And the rest of the Fantastic Four is not so sure. Sue's like, Johnny, wait. And Valeria's like, but what's the help in harming, right? We should end the conflict in record time. And Reed's like, well, in my experience, usually the opposite is true. The more heroes that run in, the crazier things get. So, yeah, things like, yeah, I'm going to go check in with Alicia. That poor kid must be worried sick. I'm out of here. And Franklin decides, hey, I want to see Aunt Alicia. I'm going to go with Uncle Ben. And Invisible Woman's like, are you sure you love supervillain fights? Like, nope, I'm good. I'm good. I mean, it's just the Wrecking Crew. I'm not going to waste my time on this. But if Annihilus shows up, then call me, right? Otherwise, I'm out. So Valeria is super excited. She says to her mom, you heard it here first. That makes Dad, you, Uncle Johnny, and me brainstorm the all-new Fantastic Four. Because they're the first ones to get in a fight, right? And Invisible Woman says, ah, that's not how this works. You know the drill. The rest of us have superpowers. You don't. You need to hang back. And she's like, but I'm super smart. And that is a superpower. So meanwhile, Johnny's trying to tell the crowd, don't worry, the real FF is back. And the crowd's like, get out of here. The Fantastics were here first. Yeah, go Fantastics, go. Johnny's like, what? Do we come back to an alternate universe or something? Did you screw up and send us to the wrong Earth? And Reed says, no, but I stand by my assessment. I don't think they need my help. And Sue says, yeah, we're not needed here, are we? And Reed says, if my hunch is correct, I think the cast here is already a little too large. So we see the Fantastics continue to try to take out the Wrecking Crew. Johnny himself kind of gets in the way at one point, gets knocked into Wrecker, who apparently is like made out of ice, iceberg kind of guy. His flame goes out and he's like, man, what is it with me and ice guys today? And Wrecker's like, what are you doing? I had that guy on the ropes. Why'd you distract me? So meanwhile, Iceberg, as he's called, gets called out by one of the other members of the Fantastics saying, look out. He almost gets smashed by Thunderball. And somebody from the crowd says, Miss Fantastics is the best. And Reed thinks, how did they know her name? And Sue, again, Ben and Franklin had the right idea. We should have sat this one out. Meanwhile, at Ben and Alicia's apartment, Franklin's being hugged by Alicia to the point of near suffocation. And Alicia's giving, while hugging Franklin, giving the thing a hard time, saying, how could you just leave me alone on that rooftop? He's like, what are you talking about? Reed zapped me across the universe with one of his gizmos. How's it my fault? So they decide they don't want to waste another second not being married. They want to get married right away this weekend. And Thing says, whatever makes you happy, Alicia, as long as I live. Meanwhile, back at the battle on 42nd Street, the news reporter has been joined by a woman who fired off the flare gun. Her name's Brenda Banachick. And she says, how did you just happen to have that on you? He says, well, I'm glad you asked, Byron. I work here at the Baxter Building as both manager and publicist to the Fantastics. They're a dynamic new super team. They bought the Baxter Building. And I hate to point this out, but 2D, Hope, Iceberg, and Miss Fantastic had matters well in hand before the venerated, though sadly out of practice, Fantastic Four blundered in. So they do have similar powers, it seems. We've got 2D, looks like Flatman maybe, or he can stretch himself as well. Miss Fantastic, not sure what her powers are. Iceberg, obviously the analog for the Thing. And then Hope, who we haven't seen much of, not sure what her or his powers are at this point. But Brenda goes on to say, you know, it breaks my heart to see the old Fantastic Four upstage like this, especially on the day of their big return. And Byron, the reporter, says, agreed. I doubt any of us were prepared for that. And Valeria is standing there in the background. She hears this and says, prepared. Immediately butts in. The light bulb has gone off for her. And Byron says, excuse me, we're on the air. Yeah, I know. And in front of a big cheering crowd, too. And everybody's watching. And so I got to ask you, news guy, who do you think the bigger story is here? The launch of a new team of knockoffs or the return of the world-famous Fantastic Four? And Byron's like, that's a really good point. And she goes, you think? Give me that. It says, hey, Wrecker, brainstormer of the Fantastic Four. I don't know what these Fantastics are paying you, but the Fantastic Four is loaded. Whatever it is, we'll double it if you stop. What do you say? Immediately surrenders. Deal. You heard her, boys. Tools down. And 2D's like, is this for real? Oh, this looks so bad. And Reed says, good work, Brainstorm. I was wondering when you'd figure it all out. She's like, yeah, sorry, Dad. I guess all this teleporting is kind of like jet lag and it was throwing me off. And so the reporter wants to know how they knew it was a staged fight. And Valeria says, well, it's the signs. Like, this is their first appearance. How do they have signs pre-made? And meanwhile, 2D's like, Brenda, say something. As Miss Fantastic is muttering, would have gotten away with it if it weren't for that meddling kid. And so it looks like the crowd, they're worried they're in trouble too. Like, hey, we're just hired extras. They told us to hold these billboards, told us where to stand. We're not in trouble, right? And Brenda's like, no, we're not, because I got all the proper permits and I paid off the jewelry store. And Valeria's like, yeah, and you hired known felons. Good luck with that. And as they're being led away, the Wrecking Crew just wants to know, we're still going to get paid, right? And Valeria's like, no, I lied. I'm a teenager. I didn't have a legal right to make that offer. And Wrecker's yelling at her, we had a deal. So whatever legal matters Miss Banachek will have to deal with, I think it's safe to say from their earnest reactions here that the Fantastics themselves didn't know about this. Now that's Reed defending them. And Miss Fantastic tells Brenda, you are so fired. And Daryl, 2D, wants to know what happens to the Baxter Building. The Fantastics own it, not Miss Banachek. And Reed's like, well, if that's the case, it's yours free and clear. We're not going to fight you for it. And meanwhile, Johnny Storm's like, huh? And Reed reminds them that the Fantastic Four aren't a building or matching outfits or a team. They're a family, and that's never going to change. And so it's almost a changing of the guard here. They say, use the Baxter Building. World can always use more heroes. But if you fall short of that legacy, we'll be here in a second to straighten you up. So meanwhile, Thing shows up with a Fantasticar, takes the rest of the Fantastic Four back to his place, number 4 Yancey Street. And they wonder, well, how are we all gonna stay with you, Ben? Like, we're not all gonna fit in your apartment. Ben's like, I own the whole building. It's fine. And Reed immediately, I have some ideas how we could modify the structure, make it a true headquarters. And Thing's like, oh, here we go. You're starting to scare me, Reed. And Sue says, oh, Ben, I almost forgot. Where should we forward our mail? What's the address here? And Ben says, trust me, you're going to like this bit, and closes the door so they see the 4 on the front, number 4 Yancey Street. So Dan Slott's Fantastic Four, it's great to have, first of all, to have the Fantastic Four back in the Marvel Universe. They were gone far, far too long. I like Dan Slott's take on the Fantastic Four. It's somewhat lighthearted. It's very adventure-driven as opposed to superhero-driven. He's not trying to do the dark and gritty. I think he's really trying to go for the adventuresome feel. Like, the Fantastic Four, more than being heroes, superheroes, they are explorers, right? That's where they work best for me anyway. And the fact that we have Franklin and Valeria there as well now, they're more than 4, but maybe they'll only do 4 at a time. Maybe, I mean, Ben's probably going to go on a honeymoon with Alicia. And does it really matter at the end of the day? I think you still have to call them the Fantastic Four. But bottom line is, they are a family, like Reed said. And again, I think that the job that Dan Slott is doing is really, really good. He's got the mood, the tone, the voice of everybody down really well. If I have any nitpick about the issue so far, it's that it's paced a little slow for my taste. I would like it to move along a little faster. I mean, we're on issue 4 and they've barely gotten back to Earth. I would just like to pick it up. And that's not to say that there's not a lot of dialogue. I mean, it's a Dan Slott book, so he tends to be a little higher on the dialogue. But a lot of the dialogue in this book was spent on the Fantastics, which, while they seem interesting enough, I'm not picking up this book to read about the Fantastics. And I can only imagine they're going to come back and be a part of the book at various times over Slott's run. They definitely seem young. They seem to have potential. But again, I'm not really interested in them. It's kind of like, they remind me a little bit of the Great Lakes Avengers, which, while funny and humorous and good for a laugh, it's not why I buy the book. I'm buying this book to read about the Fantastic Four. And again, I need Fantastic Four stuff to start happening a little quicker. This does feel like, man, it's coming out really, really slow. As far as the art on the book, You know, it was supposed to be Sarah Pacelli. It was sold as being Sarah Pacelli. I think she did like one issue, one and a half issues, and now she's been replaced already. That's a big disappointment to me. I don't know if she left Marvel, if she doesn't want to do work for the Big Two anymore. I'm just not sure what's going on. The Stefano Caselli and Nico Leone art is fine. I don't like it anywhere near as much as Sarah Pacelli's art. I don't think it's as dynamic, but it is clean. It does suit the story very well. And the color work is also done really, really well. They're pretty primary colors by Eric Arseniguia. So I think that works well with the Fantastic Four book because it is, even though it's an adventure book more than a superhero book, having those bright primary colors and just a very bright overall colored book suits kind of the light tone. Again, this is not dark and gritty. This is fun, entertaining comics. And if we could get a little more story each issue, a little more progression, it would be even more fun and even more entertaining, at least for me. So Fantastic Four has been exceptional since it's been back. And I hope that Dan Slott keeps up the good work and picks up the pace a little, as I said. All right, next up, I'm going to talk about Ironheart number one. This is from the creative team of writer Eve L. Ewing. We have Kevin LeBronda and Luciano Vecchio as the artist, Jaffo handling additional layouts, Matt Miller doing the colors, and Clayton Cowles handling the letter and production. Now, I picked this up because it was a number one, and I usually like to pick up number ones from Marvel to check them out, to give you my opinion on them as a new series. You know, a number one's a great jumping on point. It's why Marvel does so many great or does so many number ones over the past, whatever, 10 years, to the point where I really wish they would stop. But at the same time, it's a new character, a relatively new character. She's never had her own title before. So can it work? Will it work? What are my thoughts on it? Now, I am caught up on Tony Stark Iron Man. However, I did not read the previous Iron Man title where Ironheart made her debut. I think I might have read the first issue or two of it, and then, although I kept buying it, I haven't read it. I fell behind. It just wasn't one of those titles that I kept up with. And then I heard about Tony Stark disappearing when they did the whole, I don't even remember, all new Marvel Now? Marvel Now Again or something like that, when Iron Man got replaced, and it was before Generations when supposedly they were bringing back all the generational heroes. And I heard the rumor about Tony Stark being replaced by a teenage person of color, a female person of color, and I was like, you know, I'm kind of glad I'm not reading it because I have nothing against a teenage person of color being Iron Man, but if you want to have a teenage female person of color wear an Iron Man suit, then just make a new, don't make her Iron Man, just make her her own character. Because when I want to read about Iron Man, I want to read about Tony Stark. You know, there's the classic stories when James Rhodes has donned the armor, and those are okay too, but I never liked them as much as Tony Stark in the armor. And eventually Rhodes became War Machine, and I was happy about that because, again, it's a way to get more characters on this page and more characters on the screen and more diverse characters, and it's fine. Like, stop co-opting other identities for these new characters. Just let them be their own characters. Create new characters. And so I was glad to hear that Ironheart was getting her own title. So I'm much more interested in reading about Riri Williams as Ironheart as opposed to Iron Man. I don't know that I would go for that name. I mean, the name Ironheart doesn't really roll off the tongue. It's like kind of like, I think they could have come up with a better name, but that's neither here nor there. It's nice to see her get her own title. That being said, I didn't have any plans to read this beyond the first issue. Again, I was just going to pick it up. I've never read any comic with Ironheart in it, with Riri Williams in it. I was going to pick it up, check it out, give you my thoughts, and kind of move on. Because again, it's not a character that really interests me. And plus, I already read so many books, I really don't want to add another one. So let me give the synopsis on the issue, and then I will talk about my thoughts on how I feel if that's really the way it's going to go. And I should mention this feels like a lot of story here. It's more than 20 pages, typical 20 pages. So I think it's double-sized first issue. And it starts off with Riri saying that she was never meant to fly. And she's not sure how it all happened. She kind of gives a really brief synopsis in a way of how she came to be donning the Ironheart armor and how her life changed so much from being a no-name black girl messing around alone in the garage in Chicago. And she became a superhero, and she still feels like in a lot of ways she shouldn't be there. Her father got killed. Her father was dead before she was born. Her stepdad and her best friend, Natalie, were killed right in front of her. And what did she do that allowed her, like, why did she deserve to live them and not deserve to live and not them? Why does she deserve to fly and not everybody, right? And these days, she spends so much time alone flying around trying to figure that out, and she doesn't have any answers. And she always has to come back down to Earth because no matter how much it feels to be free and the desire that she has to stay up there all day, she eventually has to come back down to Earth, and where she comes back down to is the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She's been given her own lab at MIT, and when she enters that lab, there's a bunch of functionaries and dignitaries there, and she's surprised by that because she's not the most socially comfortable person. And she talks to the dean, and the dean says, well, you know, there's this event that's going on, this summit for all these dignitaries that are here, and I thought that they would like a sneak peek at your lab to show them what you're working on. And she's like, okay, I got it loud and clear. And they all have on translators, so she doesn't have to worry about speaking their individual languages. She can just speak in English, and it's translated into whatever language they need it to be, as well as when they talk, it's translated to English so she can understand them. So she shows them around at a few of the things she's working on, starting with these glasses that allow for microscopic scale analysis, working on it in terms of being able to be used in forensics for crime scenes and such. And they put it on and they look around and they're like, oh my God, your skin and everything in this room is crawling with bugs and vermin. It's wretched. And obviously it's microbes, it's germs, it's bacteria, you know, it covers everything. And Riri's like, oh yeah, I guess it is kind of gross to live in the microscopic world. So, and the dean is like shaking his head, like, you're supposed to be impressing these people, not grossing them out with bugs. So moving on, she shows them a dive suit that she created. She's like, I made this experimental suit, and you could create a dive suit. You could journey to the center of the ocean, and it would keep your rib cage from collapsing like a piece of aluminum foil and every tissue in your body being shredded to unrecognizable. And she sees the look on everybody's face. She's like, oh yeah, sorry about the graphic imagery. And the dean's like, anything else? You know, maybe something not gross. And so she shows them an arm cannon that's also a 3D printer, and it glows in the dark. And they're like, oh yeah, let me see. And so as the dignitaries are passing that around, taking a look, a few of them are talking to her, saying, wow, you're an engineer. Does that follow a lifelong interest for you? Were you toying with things in your garage as a kid? And she's like, yeah, lifelong interest. Yes, my father's dead. Next question. And the next woman says, yeah, I read that your father was shot and killed and your best friend. And yet Ironheart is a weapon to you. She's like, no, Ironheart is not a weapon. Ironheart is an engineer who uses many tools, including force sometimes, but I try to avoid that. So the next guy up asks about an AI in the suit, wants to know if it has a personality, like Tony Stark's famous Friday. And Ruby's like, actually, I've been really working on that because I'm running analytics on my own behavior, and I want to synthesize an AI that serves as a complement to that. And all of a sudden, the blaster, the arm cannon that doubles as a 3D printer goes off. And Riri runs over there and grabs it. Meanwhile, the dean's yelling at her, like, what are you doing? Someone could have been killed. She's like, I'm sorry. Nothing like that's ever happened before. And the dean says, well, if you can't address basic safety concerns, perhaps we shouldn't be letting you run your own lab after all. And Riri's not about to be talked to like that. She says, well, maybe if you didn't treat this workspace like a zoo and drop by whenever you want with your little field trip, there wouldn't be any safety concerns. And so the dignitaries leave, and the dean says, yes, we're behind schedule. We need to go. We'll discuss this later, Miss Williams. And so then Riri tries to turn the charm back on, saying, ah, bye, thanks for visiting, have fun. Please never come back to my lab because I have no idea what just happened. Take care now. And she immediately puts on those microscopic goggles, and she's trying to figure out what's going on with her plasma cannon. A couple other students come by, invite her to lunch. She begs off, saying, I need to work. And outside of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, the world leaders are about to gather for their summit. They just finished filing into the building. And then all of a sudden, we see windows of cars shattering. We see all the people, including the reporter, collapsing to their knees, as well as the police. They're all being affected by some sound that's debilitating. And there's also some sort of a wall or an invisible shield blocking them and keeping them from getting into the Kennedy building where they where all the dignitaries are. So Riri's still working in her lab, trying to figure out what's going on with the 3D printer / plasma cannon. And she gets an alert saying, alert, alert, unusual police activity detected in proximity. And her first response is, man, I need to hurry up and get a real AI. That disembodied HAL voice is whack. So she asks the computer to pull up some relevant news footage from the last few minutes. She sees what's going on outside. She says, well, broken arm cannon's going to have to wait. And she's got to run down the street for a minute. Meanwhile, inside the building, we see that all the hostages are being held by some guy in a black and white costume. And he says that for their own protection, he wants them to all hide under the table as he takes out the police guards that are inside. When Riri gets to the building, she notices everyone talking about a noise. Make it stop. She's like, I don't hear any noise. What are they talking about? So she analyzes the environment around her, finds the frequency that's driving everyone crazy, and she realizes that someone is using sound as a weapon. So she does a quick manual override of her audio input so she can get some data on the sound. And then she accesses all wireless transmissions from the last 4 hours of her lab. She wants to isolate any that don't appear in the record for the last 2 days. And they find 12 such transmissions, one for each dignitary. So that's got to be the translators of those dignitaries. And she taps into it, and then she's able to hear what the dignitaries hear. So she hears the villain say that he's going to hold them hostage there. And they've all been fitted with sonic nanotransponders that override the safety settings on their translators. And he can use it to immobilize them or literally rip their organs out of the body. They're completely under his control. So Riri runs a voice ID and finds out that the villain is Clayton Cole. Confirmed identity of Clash. Used to work at Parker Industries. He's kind of a genius. He's not a good guy, but he's definitely a genius. And as she's eavesdropping on Cole, he says, an hour ago, I personally tested the remote activation of one of these transponders, and I know that I have what it takes to get what I want. And Riri realizes, well, that must be what set off the plasma cannon, so that mystery is solved, but she's got to figure out how to get into the building. So she finds a way to vibrate her armor to an anti-phase of the sound waves that are creating the barrier and manages to get into the building. She then confronts Cole, destroys his gun that he's holding, but he's like, it doesn't really matter. I still have all of these dignitaries as hostages. I'm going to show the 10 rings that I belong. And she's like, okay, you do whatever you want to do. I don't really care. And she grabs one of the dignitaries, takes him down a floor to the panic room, where once his retina is scanned, the panic room opens and Riri has a plan. So Cole shows up soon after with the rest of the hostages saying, I don't know what your plan is, little girl. You can't save them one by one. You can't get out of the building, and I'll follow you wherever you go, along with the rest of these hostages. So Riri isolates the translators from earlier and sends everyone a message that only they can hear and Cole cannot, and says, okay, everyone, act calm. I'm going to give you the signal in just a minute, and I want you to hold your breath and be ready to run. So then what Riri does is activate the fire sprinklers, and she tells everybody, get underwater, take the headgear off, the sound waves he's using to control you, act differently underwater so they won't exactly work. Here's your chance to get that headgear off, be out of the control of Clash, and get away. So they all leave the panic room, and Clash says, well, I gotta admit, that was pretty impressive, but you think I care if you destroy my equipment? Because the world leaders are still trapped in here. My barrier still has them lying on the ground screaming like the rest of those fools. And Riri says, you know what? That's a good point. And I know you're using the local power grid to operate those transponders. So all I need to do is cause a blackout. And sure enough, when she causes blackout, the barrier goes down. And again, Clash says, the darkness is not going to stop me. Ever heard of echolocation? And Riri's response to that is, ever heard of my semi-autonomous electromagnetic power microdes? That's right, you haven't, because I haven't patented them yet. And they basically are shackles, which she uses to subdue Clash. And she tells him, yeah, you lost, kick rocks, Clash. And as he's being led away by the SHIELD agents, Clash tells Riri, you know the tragic thing, girl? You and I are the same in so many ways. Maybe you can't see it today, but it's true. I only hope that someone with your talents doesn't let people just throw you away like they did me. And he says, maybe you deserve this more than I do, and gives her the Ten Rings token. Because Clash wasn't even actually a member of the Ten Rings. He was, quote unquote, dressing for the job he wanted rather than for the job he had. He was trying to kidnap those dignitaries, blackmail them, use them as hostages to get weapons, to get influence, to get power, and show the Ten Rings that he was a force to be reckoned with, to hopefully be invited to their organization. So as the paramedics tell Ironheart that she did a good job, they wonder, what's she going to do now? Go celebrate, kick back with some friends. And Ironheart's like, yeah, thanks. You know, actually, I need to get back to the lab. And as she flies off, she thinks to herself, you know what? I beat the bad guy. I could have died. And the fate of the world was literally in my hands. But you know what the scary part is? The fact that I know he's right. We are alike. Because when everyone tells you you're brilliant, it seems like no one really sees you. Like, what's the point, right? Everybody sees you for what you can do rather than who you are. And Riri knows that that couldn't be a problem. She's lonely, right? So she falls asleep in her lab, wakes up when her phone rings at 12:51 a.m., answers it. It's a friend from back home, Xavier. He's there to ask her if she wants to go see a movie tomorrow or hang out. And she says, you know, actually, I'm back at MIT rather than home in Chicago, so check it out. And she shows him around the lab with her iPhone, a FaceTime, I guess. And he's like, oh, that's awesome. Why are you there now? It's super late, right? Didn't you have a long day? She's like, I'm researching some stuff and trying to get the AI going. Like, what are you doing up this late? And he's like, I was watching a movie and thought, why don't I give my famous neighbor a call? And all of a sudden, it dawns on Riri, like, hey, how did you get my number? And Xavier blushes and is like, Riri, I've known you since we were little kids. Yeah, Riri says, but I don't remember giving you my number. So Xavier, you can tell, reluctantly confesses that it was Riri's mommy or mama that gave her the number. It's like, yeah, she said you didn't have any friends at school. And Riri's like, oh, so I'm a charity case, right? Don't waste your time, Xavier. I'm good. And she's about to hang up. And he's like, hey, it's fine. It's chill. If you don't want to talk, I just thought. She says, you know what? I'm good. Okay, good night. And he's like, wait. Hold up. What do you want? Is that a Geordi visor? Are you experimenting with the Geordi LaForge visor from Star Trek The Next Generation for your suit? And Riri's like, it's cosplay. And he's like, huh? It's cosplay. It's cosplay, right? Another loser thing I do because I'm a nerdy loser with no friends. And Xavier's like, well, actually, I really like Star Trek. And so then it starts them down the path of finding that they have common interests. And then they start talking about music and food. And it seems like they're really connecting. And they start talking about video games. Xavier feels comfortable enough to share some of his music that he makes for Riri. And they really, really seem to be hitting it off, which is, it's almost surprising they didn't realize, being that they've known each other for so long, childhood friends, that they didn't realize how much they actually had in common. So Riri says, well, hey, it's really late. I probably should go. And at the same time, Xavier is saying, why did you become Ironheart? And that makes her pause. She's like, wait, what? Well, sorry, maybe it's a personal question, but why do you do it, Riri? Like, you could get hurt. And she says, well, I was at school. I built a suit. Like, yeah, I know how, but that doesn't tell me why. She's like, I don't, what do you mean why? Because I could, I don't know. And he's like, that's not an answer. Where we come from, right? In Chicago, in the hood, nothing's guaranteed. Nothing's promised. We've lost so many people. So why? And Riri feels, she's a little bit overcome with emotion. And she's like, trust me, I know. And Xavier says, I didn't mean it that way. I'm sorry. Obviously, your dad and you know, Natalie. But what if something happened to you out there? You know, I know your mom plays it cool, but she's got to be worried sick. Like, what? Like, you could die. And Riri says, well, you know what? My stepdad used to say this thing all the time. Those who move with courage make the path for those who live in fear. So I was tired of being afraid. I wanted to fly. And Xavier says, yeah, you know, it seems like you really had the perfect father. And Riri says, no, but he tried real hard. And I guess since he's not here, I feel like the best that I can do is try to walk the path that he made for me, you know? And Xavier says, yeah, I think I understand. I don't know if I agree, but I get it. And she says, like, all right, well, I really should get some sleep. And he says, yeah, I'm going to crash too, but talk to you tomorrow, okay? And Riri says, yeah, that would be cool. And hangs up, and she's repeating his goodbye, talk to you tomorrow, homie. And it seems like she's smitten all of a sudden. And as she's standing there looking at the armor, she gets a snort, talking to yourself, Riri, you need some sleep, girl. And disembodied voice there. And as we turn the page, we see what looks to be a hologram of her best friend, Natalie, and the shocked look on Riri's face saying, Natalie? So my guess is, as far as that kind of cliffhanger goes, is this is the AI finally manifesting itself. The AI is calling itself Natalie. And I don't know, subconsciously, inadvertently, Riri has kind of infused the AI with Natalie's personality. And I haven't read any Ironheart before. I don't know if Natalie was complimentary in terms of personality and her mannerisms and the way she saw the world and everything. Because again, Riri, you remember early on in the issue, she was telling the dignitary that she was hoping to create an AI that could complement her and could be strong where she's weak. So I don't know Natalie. I don't know if she was ever part of the book or part of Riri's story before. And did she compliment Natalie? But that's my guess on that. I like that it's extra sized. I like that it's a double sized issue. It's like the first half is adventure showing Riri, you know, holding her own against a villain, not exactly a huge name villain, but, you know, learning, getting experience. And the second half is more personal, getting to know Riri, seeing her starting to maybe possibly develop a budding relationship with Xavier. We get insight into why she does what she does. So I think for new readers, if this is the first issue of Ironheart you're picking up, like it is mine, I think Eve Ewing did an incredible job of making this very enjoyable, most likely for longtime readers of Ironheart, because again, you get that action, you get the kind of the status quo where Riri's at right now, where she's at in terms of her head and her, you know, emotion. She's lonely, she's at school, she feels a little bit out of place, feels like she doesn't have any friends. So we get to see that aspect of it, where she is as a superhero when she fights against Clash, where she is in terms of her relationships and how she's relating to herself. And we also get that insight into how much she cared about her stepdad, how much she misses her best friend, why she does what she does as Ironheart. So I think all of that works really, really well. And I mentioned before I started covering the issue in depth, doing the synopsis, how I planned on picking up this first issue, and then I just was going to check it out, give you my thoughts, and be done. Man, this is done so well, I'm completely planning on picking up issue two. Part of why I had my reservations was things like Squirrel Girl or Spider-Gwen, which I've read and have not enjoyed at all. I think that those books tend to be, I don't know, they just didn't interest me. I don't think they have the depth that Eve Ewing is able to give Riri as a character. Especially Squirrel Girl, it's just kind of like, you know, it's entertaining, it's lighthearted, and there's just no depth. And that totally has its place. And if you like it and you like the humor and everything, I don't begrudge you that at all. I think Squirrel Girl definitely has a place and it has an audience, and that's all fine and dandy. It's just not something that interests me. Something like this, where we're getting into a character in more depth, we're understanding why she does what she does, we're understanding her emotions, we're going to watch her grow, we're going to watch her go on a character arc, we're going to watch her make mistakes, there's probably going to be tragedy and heartache along the way. That's what I want to read. That is good storytelling. That is a way to get somebody hooked. And so for me, this first issue, Eve Ewing knocked it out of the park. Absolutely spectacular. She went from it's not like I went in here thinking, okay, I might read it, I might not. Like, I went in thinking I'm not going to like this, which isn't the best way to go into a first issue. I freely admit that. It was my own prejudice and my own bias. I was basing what I expected on this first issue from other things, like I said, Spider-Gwen and Squirrel Girl, which I tried and just didn't work for me. And so even going in with not a completely open mind, that just goes to show you the strength of this first issue, what an incredible job Eve Ewing did of making it new reader friendly, making it interesting, making it compelling. If I have any nitpick about Ironheart, I don't like the costume. You know, it's based on the Iron Man suit, but it's not as sleek or as slick. I don't care for the little like shoulder blade things, shoulder pads or whatever. I don't like the helmet because it has like the ears that pop out and the thing on top that looks like the light on a miner's helmet. The fact that it's like pink, I guess that's not as big of a deal. But I don't know. It's a minor nitpick. On the cover, the mask is see-through. Whereas inside the book, it's not. And I definitely prefer when it's not, because I think it looks even worse when the mask is like clear glass or whatever it might be. I don't like the look of that. So again, I think it's something minor. And I think over time, if her costume gets tweaked a little bit, I'd be fine with that. I also, as I mentioned, Ironheart, I don't think is the best name for a character. I kind of wish I understand that she has ties to Iron Man, but just let her be out on her own. She doesn't need to have her name doesn't need to tie into Iron. Doesn't need to have the word Iron in it at all, in my opinion. So anyway, those are minor things. I think overall, the thing to take away from this book is it's really, really good. And I think Eve Ewing does an incredible job of capturing the voice of Riri and making her feel authentic, making her feel realistic from her dialogue and her vocabulary and her reactions. They all seem authentic in terms of who we know Riri to be as a person. So I love all that. I love how she made it super new reader friendly. I can't wait to see where it goes from here. An incredible job. Best first issue I've read of a comic in a really long time. So kudos to the entire creative team. Really, really well done. I figured I would read it and probably be saying, yeah, if you're a fan of Ironheart, you're going to like it. And if you're not a fan of Ironheart, then, you know, maybe you want to check it out, maybe not. And I'm saying like, p- pick this book up. That is what I'm telling you. That is my recommendation after reading Ironheart. It is 100% a book that you should check out. It captures the spirit of early Marvel comics very well, especially I would say almost a Spider-Man or a Fantastic Four kind of feel. Fantastic Four in that, you know, Reed was always coming up with crazy inventions and it had that adventurous kind of feel to it. And Spider-Man in that this is a teenage superhero who's kind of learning on the job. So it has that aspect as well. So again, great job by the entire creative team. All right, let me go ahead and talk about issue 11 of Charles Soule's Daredevil run, written by Charles Soule, art by Ron Garney, colors by Matt Milla, letters by Clayton Cowles. As we saw last issue, Daredevil, or Blindspot rather, discovered this gruesome work of art that was painted in blood, 113 different people's blood to make this work of art. And it was kind of left at that as the issue wound to a close with Daredevil saying it was his case and he was hoping to find out who was responsible. So as issue 11 starts, we're in Brooklyn. We see this strange looking man running down an alley. His skin is bluish white and he's being pursued by like what looks to be gang members, but we find out they're just regular guys in the neighborhood, and they confront this strange looking man, and they're asking him why he's running, what he's afraid of. Maybe he should look in a mirror. It should be them that are afraid of him. And he says, "I'm not a monster. My name's Marty Makowitz. I grew up in this neighborhood. And then that stupid damn Terrigen Mist came down. I breathed some of that crap and I woke up like this. I'm one of them Inhumans. That's all. It ain't my fault." And one of the gang members says, "Yeah, it sounds like bad luck. And maybe that luck will turn around someday, but today is not that day." And they're telling him, "Hey man, it's not personal. We're just protecting our neighborhood." And he's like, "Protecting a neighborhood? Like, what are you talking about? I'm not dangerous. I've got a little HVAC business in the neighborhood. Like, what am I going to do to anybody? Like, you have powers, right? We hear you guys with powers. You change. People end up burning things down. There's destruction. Neighborhood gets destroyed. And you might not mean for it to happen, but it does. Well, we ain't letting it happen here." And Marty says, Powers? This is what I got. I can make glow-in-the-dark snowflakes. It's just light. It's no danger to anybody except people trying to sleep." And he even demonstrates. So these snowflakes pop up in the air. And the gang member says, "Sorry, pal, can't take the chance. Your powers might change." And then we get a voice off panel saying, "Beautiful," and surprises the gang members. And the mysterious person takes them out relatively quickly. And Marty says, "Thank you. You saved my life, but did you just kill those guys?" And the figure says, "Don't worry, it's all over now." Meanwhile, back at Washington Heights, the blood mural, we see a figure asking, "Professor, is this art?" And the professor says, "Yes, Mr. Durin, of course it's art, because art is just creation with intent, and that's all you need. So if you're trying to communicate an idea by making something, that's art, and whoever made this had quite a bit to say." And Mr. Dern's like, "Oh, that's great. You can call me Freddy, and I get what you're saying, but you know, this is the whole reason that I brought you up here, Professor Grover. I wanted to know if it's art." And he says, "Well, it is art, but is it good art? And more specifically, is it worth anything? Well, the execution is solid, and whoever did this had skill, but I don't know that it's going to hang in the Met someday, but you know, here's the thing, right? According to the police reports I've read, this mural was painted with blood, and with this world being what it is, somebody's going to want it. I'm sure you'll have no problem finding a buyer." And Freddy says, "Man, that's great. Maybe I'll get you involved when I go to sell it, right? You can help me figure out a price and someone to sell it to, and you get yourself a little commission." Professor Grover's like, "Hey, now that the FBI and the NYPD have had their investigation, you obviously can do what you want, but I didn't say that I wanted to have anything to do with this. You know, you're charging admission for people to come and see it. Now you're talking about selling it. Isn't that a little ghoulish? Like, people may have died in the creation of this." And Freddy says, "Yeah, but that's not my fault, right?" And then another person walks in and says, "Hi, Dad. Sorry to interrupt. It's Patrick, Freddy's son." And he says, no interruption, Patrick. Professor is just giving me the good news. It sounds like we're going to make all right out of this deal. And Patrick's like, okay, well, that's great, but something's happening outside. And Freddie says, yeah, there's a line around the block, $10 a pop last time I checked. And he says, no, it's not that. There's a lady out there making some noise and she brought the cops. And Freddie's like, whatever. I checked with my lawyer, private property. I can do whatever I want. Cops can't do anything. Let her in if she pays her $10. I don't care what she thinks. And as we turn the page, we see the woman there with the police officers flanking her, saying, how dare you? And Freddie's like, how dare I what? Who are you, lady? And she says, and one of the cops actually says, well, this is Andrea Pearson. She's a city councilwoman, so maybe dial up the respect. And Pearson says, actually, I'm the speaker of the council. In fact, the only person I answer to is the mayor, if I feel like it. And this plan of yours, Mr. Frederick Dernan, is an absolute disgrace, and I'm not going to allow it to proceed. And Freddie says, you can't do anything. I don't care who you are. It's America. It's my property. I know my rights. And who are you? Anyway, why do you care? It's none of your business. You don't want to see the painting? Don't look. And again, the police officer is trying to defuse the situation, tell him to calm down. And Andrea Pearson says, I'll tell you why I care. DNA results came back, and that obscenity that you're staring at, some of the blood you're so eager to profit from, came from my niece. So I thought I was going to be able to appeal to your humanity, right? And all the other families that are steeped in uncertainty and grief over the loss of loved ones, and maybe persuade you to keep from opening the site to the public. And Freddie says, why should I? This is Professor Cassius Grover from Pratt University, and he's telling me this thing's worth a lot of money, and you just want me to walk away from that? And Grover raises his hand. He's like, I'm only here in a professional capacity. I would never try to profit from this terrible situation. Please don't lump me in with this guy. And again, Pearson's like, well, obviously, trying to appeal to your humanity is not going to work, Mr. Dernan, because that would require you to be human. So let me give you another angle. I'm a very powerful woman, and if you want to test those powers, just see what happens. And Freddie kind of stares at her for a minute and says, hey, Patrick, go open the doors. We want to keep the crowd waiting. And so he goes to do as he's told, telling Pearson, hey, what are you going to do? Meanwhile, at the district attorney's office, Lower Manhattan, Matt Murdock has been called into the district attorney's office, and he's thinking to himself how he has no idea why he's being called in. You know, for all his enhanced senses, he can sense that Hawk had a tuna salad for lunch, his coffee is cold, he's got how many pieces of paper on his desk, his shoes are off. But the future? What Benjamin Hochberg, aka the Hawk, aka the Manhattan DA, called Matt for, he has no idea. But his guess is he's about to get fired. And the reason he expects that is because he did leave a few weeks back in the middle of his night court shift because Blindspot had called about the blood mural. And as Daredevil, he's been so busy trying to find whoever painted it that he's kind of been neglecting his caseload. And so he does expect to be fired. So as he goes in and sits down, Hochberg says, you know, I don't really care how you handle your shifts. Horse trading is done now and then, but you just walked out and left all your cases in an ADA's hands with no notice. That didn't really win you any friends, and you definitely could use a few. Matt's like, here it comes. He's going to drop the hammer on me. And Matt says, well, I apologize if there's anything I can do to show my commitment to this office, because Daredevil's like, he can't fire me. I've barely started. And Hochberg says, well, funny you should mention that, because I do have an assignment for you. Andrea Pearson asked to see if someone from this office might be able to shut down a certain sideshow from Washington Heights that's been happening. And supposedly you're our best litigator, so can you please do me a favor? Prove it. So on the next page, we see that Matt meets up with Foggy Nelson, his longtime law partner, commenting on the fact that Foggy's one of his oldest friends and one of the few who knows that he is Daredevil. And he's not sure why Matt's not sure why they have the meetings, because they're so uncomfortable. It seems like their friendship has not stood the test of time with whatever Matt did to get his secret identity back. Matt's like, you know, I'm not here to talk about that. I want to tell you and ask your opinion about the thing that's been going on in Washington Heights. You know about that? And Matt's like, or Foggy rather is like, yeah, you know, you might be blind, but I'm not. It's all over every newspaper. They're calling the guy Vincent Van Gore. And Matt says, that's hilarious. But my problem is the DA's office got leaned on by Andrea Pearson, and now I'm supposed to find a way to shut him down. And Foggy's like, yeah, I heard he was charging admission for people to gawk at that thing. Charming, right? And the most New York thing I've ever heard. And Matt's like, well, it'll be easy enough to shut it down. And Foggy's like, yeah, you know, public nuisance, go after his permitting, maybe get the cops to reopen the scene. And Matt's like, well, obviously, but that's not why I wanted to talk to you. It'd be easy to get it shut down, but it feels like the DA's office is supposed to be about justice, not shutting down some guy's business because it gets on City Hall's nerves. And Foggy's like, wait, you're conflicted about this? It sounds like this Dernan guy is a grade A scumbag. And Matt's response to that is, well, yeah, this time it's a scumbag. But what happens if next time City Hall decides to lean on somebody who's decent? And Foggy says, yeah, well, that's why I always preferred defense work. You get to decide where, how, and why you will exercise your legal skills. But you wanted to be a DA, Matt, and all your wishes came true. So now you've got to do what they tell you. He stands up, puts a 10 on the table, and walks away. So meanwhile, in Washington Heights, Freddie Dernan's getting ready to open his quote-unquote gallery again. And the same cops that were there a few nights ago have returned, and they're commenting that it looks like this Dernan guy is really raking it in. And the one cop says to the other, are you surprised? He's like, unfortunately, not really. So Dernan sees them coming and comments to the crowd that, hey, I'm going to open in just a few minutes. No flash photography. It could hurt the artwork. And I'll be opening up soon. And the cops tell them, actually, no, sir, that won't be happening. He's like, what? You guys are hassling me again? Why don't you go write some bogus parking tickets or something? He's like, sorry, sir, you're not going to be able to open tonight. We've got an injunction. It means you're not able to open until the court decides if what you're doing here is actually legal. And Freddie realizes that it's the lady oh-so-miss-powerful, sick the DA's office on him. And he calls out to the crowd saying, sorry, it looks like nobody's going to be able to come in. And a bunch of babies don't want to see important works of art. And he's like, what? What? Why would you do this to me? And the cops are like, hey, let's just take it down a notch. To which Dernan responds, what, you're going to step on my freedom of speech too? Ah, this is terrible. I'm going to sue you guys. You can't do this. It's America. And the cops say, hey, Mr. Dernan, we have to enforce this injunction. You can't let these people in. And he says, I ain't letting anyone in, but it's still my place. You're going to tell me I can't go into my own place? I don't think so. He walks in and realizes that the show's over in more ways than one because his painting has been painted over. And there's a message scrawled across it saying, you're only as good as your last performance. So the cops immediately call for a forensics team. Seems that someone's defaced a blood mural and added a message that includes an address. And we see on the next page that Sam and Matt are headed to that address. It's in the Bronx, 1602 East 171st Street. And Sam's wondering why Matt brought him along. He says, well, to be my eyes, right? You got to describe whatever's in here to our acrobatic mutual friend. Sam's like, wait, Daredevil's working on this? Matt says, of course he is. He's always working. So they enter into the warehouse, and what they find is a bunch of different Inhumans. One is watching TV, one is washing his hands, one is on the toilet, one is changing a tire, another is eating, a final is ironing, and they all appear to be dead. And as Sam describes to Matt what he sees, he mentions how they don't look quite human. Matt deduces that they're Inhumans and asks the cops if they have a liaison to New Adelan. And they mentioned they do, somebody that used to be on the force. So that's probably Frank McGee. Hopefully we're going to get a Frank McGee sighting. And Matt goes on to say, well, this tableau, it seems like it's kind of like something in irony, Inhumans doing humane things, or maybe Inhumans are humans too, right? They're doing the most mundane human tasks, watching TV, ironing, changing a tire, eating, washing their hands, using the restroom. And As Matt starts to dial in with his senses, he hears a heartbeat. And he asks if there's any private spots around there. And the officer responds, sure, the whole building's vacant for a big renovation. He was planning on leasing the next floors. So any other floor is going to be empty. So Matt, obviously, he hears the heartbeat. He thinks it's got to be something to do. Like, why would he only hear one other heartbeat? But he can't, I mean, he can't let the cops know he's Daredevil. Sam doesn't even know he's Daredevil. So he gives the excuse that he needs to call an informant that he forgot about. And if he doesn't, he'll lose him as an informant. Tell Sam, stay there. And as he climbs the stairs, he hears the movements of someone nervous, jittery sounds. Someone's watching, someone nervous. He thinks about how every half-baked cop show always trots out the idea that criminals return to the scenes of their crimes. And that's just not true. Ask any cop, criminals aren't idiots, not even the dumb ones. And the dumb ones aren't that dumb. But there are a few exceptions. Arsonists, for example, they come back, or rather they never leave because they want to see it burn. But this guy isn't a criminal like that. He doesn't see himself as a criminal. He's an artist. And the one thing that artists want to do is see the reaction of their work unveiled for the first time. So he's there, he's watching, his heart is pounding, he's sweaty, he's anxious. And as Daredevil lands on the roof, we see this guy, and he's crying blood, it looks like, down his face to this, it looks like almost an exposed heart on his chest. He's white, he's wearing a beanie, and as Daredevil lands, he says, hello, did you like my work? And it's to be continued. So don't know what this guy's powers are, but he sure the heck is creepy. Did he know Daredevil was coming? Did he know Daredevil had seen his work? Did he watch Matt Murdock just change into Daredevil? All that's to be determined. So again, I'm absolutely loving Charles Soule's work on Daredevil. I love the lawyer aspects that he brings into it. Charles Soule is a lawyer himself, if you're not aware. He specializes in immigration law, but he works in those legal circles, right? So I know that when he got put on Daredevil, he talked to a lot of his colleagues, a lot of his friends, some of them working in the New York District Attorney's Office. And so he's definitely injecting this with a lot of realism, a sense of realism from terms of lawyers and the way the court system works and the way the legal system works, and examining something like this Freddie Dernan scumbag who wanted to profit off of this blood mural, and the aspects of Matt trying to juggle night court and being in the DA's office and those responsibilities with being Daredevil. I talked before on a previous podcast when I covered a Daredevil issue by Charles Soule about the Vigilante series from Marv Wolfman with Adrian Chase Vigilante, and how he struggled with being a vigilante and being a judge and working within the legal system. There's all kinds of moral aspects there. I don't know if we're going to get there with Charles Soule's Daredevil. If we don't, I definitely am going to ask Charles and discuss it with Charles next time I see him, like what his thoughts are on that, because it's so fascinating. Daredevil's a character that's been around, what, like 50 years now, if not longer? And I don't know that that's ever been explored, the aspect of Daredevil and Matt Murdock's vows and oaths that he's taken as a lawyer to uphold the law. And technically, he's breaking the law as Daredevil, taking the law into his own hands. Like, all that stuff's really interesting. And the other thing that Soule is doing is he's always infusing, or so far, he has introduced us to some really quirky villains in his Daredevil run that broach a different aspect of Daredevil that hasn't been explored a lot. Something that Charles Soule did want to explore, and that's his blindness, right? The advice that Captain America gave Daredevil, you know, am I doing the right thing? Well, can you look at yourself in the mirror? And what do you feel when you see yourself not knowing that Daredevil's blind? And he can't look at himself in the mirror. Ten fingers and the whole undocumented immigrant thing. And now this new villain that's all about perception, wants to know how his work is achieved. And, you know, we'll learn a lot more about that. Daredevil's work and Matt Murdock's partnership. And now both Daredevil and Matt Murdock are partnered up with Blindspot and his alter ego. So just like Daredevil is mentoring Blindspot, now we've got Matt Murdock in a way mentoring Sam, who is an undocumented immigrant. So all these great concepts and ideas that Charles Soule is exploring through telling these daredevil stories, and it's making it feel new, it's making it feel fresh. At the same time, if there's one thing that's very classic about what Charles Soule is doing with Daredevil, it's how down and dirty it is in terms of art and being a very street level story, being gritty and really leaning into that that aspect of Daredevil more so than like the superhero aspect. He's much more into like the Frank Miller, kind of the Frank Miller era of Daredevil, where it is very street. We're not, you know, in space. We're not going up against these villains that have these fantastical superpowers. You know, it's much more physical. It's much more ninja. It's much more visceral. It's much more tactile. And I think visceral, tactile, street level, those are all really great terms you can use to describe Charles Soule's Daredevil run. And you've cannot give enough credit to Ron Garney as his collaborator on a big chunk of Charles Soule's run for infusing the art with that same type of feel. I don't think that those aspects of the story that Charles is trying to really bring to the front, I don't know that it would be so successfully done without Ron Garney doing the art, because it's absolutely spectacular. Same thing with Matt Miller's color work. Making it feel gritty, making it feel very street, very New York. It's not a bright book. It's not a huge variety of color palette. It's a lot of blacks. It's a lot of reds. It's a lot of whites for contrast. And it's just done in a style that works so well to really bring across that gritty urban feel. And that exists throughout Charles Soule's Daredevil run. And it recently came to an end, I'm sad to say. I would have loved to have seen Charles stay on Daredevil for at least a few more years, because I think what he was doing with the character was something really, really special. So we'll continue to cover Charles Soule's Daredevil run all the way up through issue 612 on these Marvel Mondays. So don't worry, it's not going to go away for us for a while yet. So once again, I want to thank everybody for joining us. Please tell your friends about us, subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, be sure to check out all the pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.